From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. There is so much at stake in the November 2020 election, not just for the U.S., but the world. The presidency of Donald J. Trump has been a massive blow to democracy, human rights, the judiciary and the Supreme Court, journalism, and even basic decency. But the opposition Democratic Party is itself in turmoil, with centrist establishment factions holding fast to the idea that a pre-Trump status quo is best, versus a growing faction of younger progressives who want the party to live up to its stated ideals. We turn now to E.J. Dionne Jr., who writes about politics in a twice-weekly column for The Washington Post. He's also a government professor at Georgetown University, a visiting professor at Harvard, a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, and a frequent commentator on politics for National Public Radio and MSNBC. He joins me to discuss his new book, Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. Welcome to the program, Professor Dionne.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
The spectrum that of politics in America as a whole has shifted far to the right, but the spectrum of politics in the Democratic Party certainly has shifted closer to its stated ideals, it seems. And I want to go to where you start your book, Code Red. Instead of starting at the 2016 election, to remind us, you know, what happened nearly 4 years ago with Trump's win, you start at the 2018 midterm elections. You mentioned Ayanna Pressley and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Why is that a good starting point to think about bringing together the two wings of the Democratic Party?
Well, as you know, later on in the book, I do talk about what I think went wrong in 2016, sure. But I started 2018 precisely because I think in that election, the forces that I believe need to come together to change American politics actually succeeded in changing, in coming together and achieving really quite extraordinary change, a class of new Democrats in the House with the by far the largest share of women ever elected in our history, an ideological range that includes Ayanna Pressley and AOC and several others on the left side of the party, but also a group of people, again, we call them moderate, although their positions are way more progressive than the people who used to be called blue dog Democrats, people like Abigail Spanberger in Virginia, or Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey. We can go down a long list of new Democratic members. Why did 2018 happen? It happened because progressives and more moderate Democrats or center-left Democrats understood that they needed each other in order to win that election. That where they could, progressives gain ground in Democratic primaries in districts where progressives had a real shot of winning the seat. In districts like, say, Spanberger's in suburban Richmond and rural Virginia, a candidate like Pressley or AOC probably could not carry that seat, but a candidate of a somewhat more moderate but still strongly anti-Trump, strongly in favor of immigrant rights, strongly in favor of universal health care coverage, a candidate like Spanberger could win, and progressives rallied to her. It's rare when you're doing book promotion that you have a thesis in your book ratified, but I did an event at a great bookstore here in D.C. Called Politics in Prose, where a man stood up and said, you know, you're right, I'm way more progressive than Abigail Spanberger is, but I work my heart out for her because I liked her personally and because she's way better than anyone else we could get in that district. And they ran on basic issues of economic justice. They talked about health care. They talked about immigration reform. They talked about gun reform. And they talked about cleaning up a corrupt political system. So I look at 2018 as a model of what needs to be done nationally. Democrats won House races in 2018 by a margin of 20. Let's put it this way. Democrats in 2018 got 25 million more votes than Democrats had gotten in the midterm elections of 2014. That's because of mobilization and also persuasion. They really mobilized their base, but they also persuaded people that there needed to be a check on Donald Trump.
Let's refer to or revert to where the Republican Party is looking at politics these days. And it's not just Trump, but many of those who remain in the party, many have left, but those who remain in the party have essentially thrown their lot in with Trump. The Republican Party seems unrecognizable, even compared to George W. Bush's party. What happened? What happened to the party and how has it perverted American democracy?
I want to say I'm really glad you went there, because my argument is not only that progressives need to be open to moderates, but moderates, genuine moderates in our country, no longer have a place in the Republican Party, which is why they need to be willing to ally with progressives. I argue that it's important not to see Trump alone as the thing that happened to the Republican Party. Trump is the culmination of a long period of drift and rapid movement to the right. It has often been said that Republicans used to play racial politics with a dog whistle, and Trump did it with a bullhorn. But the seeds of that politics were planted as far back as Richard Nixon's Southern strategy, or a very different kind of Republican, George H.W. Bush, whom I admire in many ways. But the Willie Horton campaign he ran against Michael Dukakis in 1988 also had this racial component to it. And then if you go into the Bush years, there are two things I honor about George W. Bush, and I'm not in the habit of saying lots of great things about George W. Bush. One was that after 9/11, about 10 days after 9/11, he went to the Islamic Center here in D.C. and gave a very, very, very strong statement about the rights of Muslims in America and calling on Americans not to make American Muslims responsible. And he really called out people who would be Islamophobic in the strongest possible way. By the time Bush left, you had a Republican Party happy to follow a Fox News campaign against the so-called mosque at Ground Zero, where it wasn't a mosque, it was an Islamic center, it wasn't on Ground Zero. And yet that campaign took off, and only a very limited number of Republican voices were willing to speak up. And then I also think during George W. Bush's term, you saw the embrace of Trumpism before the fact in the rejection of immigration reform proposed by W., supported by Democrats and rejected by the Republican Party led by Jeff Sessions in Congress, who once made the very revealing statement. He said, "We tried to delay consideration of this bill so that Rush Limbaugh would have time to tell the American people what was in it." And lastly, with birtherism, and that was the sort of first big Donald Trump step, it's remarkable how much Republicans were cagey in dealing with that. They just did not go out there and denounce Donald Trump. So this Republican Party had already started moving toward the right wing before Trump came along. And he kind of finished the job of taking it in this direction that combined right-wing politics, pro-corporate politics, with ethno-nationalism, and we might as well say it, some outright forms of bigotry. But the party, unfortunately, was on this path for a long time and had been losing moderates going all the way back to the 1990s. Slowly, people, particularly in suburban areas, who were genuinely middle of the road people or very moderate conservatives, slowly came to realize I can't be in that party anymore. And a lot of the seats Democrats picked up in 2018 were seats that were once represented by moderate or even liberal Republicans. Yes, there used to be such people, and their traditional constituency said, we can't abide by the party that this party compared to the party we thought we belonged to 30 years ago.
Do you think that there is a fear among progressives that in order to accommodate those conservatives who feel left out of the Republican Party, the Nancy Pelosi's and Chuck Schumer's are going to move right, and the Bidens are going to move right rather than to the left, which is sort of traditionally where the Democratic Party has wanted to go, that those in power, at least within the party, have tried so hard to win over those mythical white rural voters, which are the same demographic that Republicans tend to go after?
I think that it's very important to see the Trump constituency in parts and not as one big monolith that can't be won over. If you look at the results of 2016, one of the most interesting data points, I think, is that on Election Day, 60% of Americans had a negative view of Donald Trump. Unfortunately for her, 55% of Americans had a negative view of Hillary Clinton. If you take the group of people who were negative on Trump and negative on Clinton, they constituted 17% of the whole electorate, and they voted 47-30 for Donald Trump. So right off the bat, of Trump's 46% of the vote, about 9% of it came from people voting primarily against Hillary Clinton. Then there's another piece of the Trump constituency that was won over either by trade issues or by being fed up with the status quo or feeling their jobs had been lost over a long period of free trade and technological change. And they were willing to give Trump a flyer vote because they were angry. That's different from the hardcore Trump vote that is immovable, rooted in nativism and often in racism. And I think you saw that some of these voters could move to very progressive candidates in 2018. Somebody like Tammy Baldwin, if you look at Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin, or Sherrod Brown in Ohio, or Bob Casey, a little bit more moderate Democrat, these Democrats were winning back about 10 or 15% of the Trump voters. So I think it's a mistake to say that winning back Trump voters requires candidates to abandon economic progressivism, to abandon their embrace of civil rights or women's rights, to abandon core progressive positions, because none of these candidates did that. And yet they won 10, 15% of the Trump vote, which is what you need. Also, doing that does not mean that you walk away from speaking for immigrants, for refugees, for African Americans, for LGBTQ people. All these candidates embraced those causes in this campaign. The last point I want to make on this is, I think what Biden is going to do is the shrewd thing, which is to look at, we forget often that positions that are called left are actually majority positions in the country.
Right.
There is majority support for universal coverage. There may be arguments about single payer, although single payer actually does pretty well in first blush in the polls. But all Americans, a majority of Americans support universal coverage. A majority of Americans support wide access to post-secondary education. A majority of Americans want to act boldly on climate change. And so I think there is a way of embracing progressive positions shrewdly, in a way that says we are not trying to impose on Americans who disagree with us some worldview that is alien to them. We are actually trying to represent interests that they hold dear and values that they say they believe in. And I think that can be done.
Is it important, in order to unite, for progressives and moderates to unite, to coalesce around issues like healthcare? We know that healthcare has been the number one issue over the past year for Americans. Even before the coronavirus pandemic, over and over again, voters said in exit polls during primary races, and even before, polls showed healthcare was their top issue. And that's a massive weakness for the Republican Party, because all they've done is railed against the Affordable Care Act, contract. They've promised a healthcare plan, and they have yet to come up with one other than a status quo free-for-all. You're, you know, basically on your own. And that's an issue that becomes even starker during the pandemic.
Precisely right. And Democrats, healthcare was the number one issue for Democrats in the 2018 election, in district after district, whether it was a rather progressive district or a more moderate or even conservative district. Voters mistrusted the Republican position, partly because Obamacare, once it was put into effect, was far more popular than it was when it was an abstraction. Now, you need to improve substantially on Obamacare. Barack Obama believes that, let alone anyone else. We need to cover everyone. The benefits need to be more generous. But the supporting Obamacare as against the Republican call to repeal it, supporting people who may have pre-existing conditions and not letting their health care be taken away, that position is so popular that Republicans pretended to hold it before the 2018 elections, and even though that contradicted what they were actually trying to do. So yes, healthcare was important before the coronavirus pandemic. And I think it so underscores why Americans need to be able to have healthcare even when they don't have jobs, when you have so many Americans right now losing their healthcare because they are losing their jobs. So that the beginning of a decoupling of healthcare coverage from employment, which the a single payer plan would do in one fell swoop, is something I think Americans would be sympathetic to doing in a gradual way, because they do not want, either for themselves or for others, to be without health coverage at a moment when everyone needs it so much.
Republicans have often very successfully waged culture wars in order to win votes. And of course, that is an easy way to go about getting oneself elected. One doesn't have to base things on fact or even policy discussions. It's more of an emotional response. And with, you know, big media outlets like Fox News available to them, it has been something they've been able to do. How do Democrats, how do liberals, progressives, you know, anyone to the left of the current Republican Party avoid the trap of the culture war?
Well, I think there are a couple of things they should do. And again, I talk about this some in the book, but I've written about this over the years. The fact that the primary religious voices in the country are on the right for white people has sort of distorted the view of religion, I think, sometimes among progressives. And I think that there are many people on the progressive side who are religious and whose values actually come from their religious tradition, whether it is from the progressive side of Catholic social thought, or in Hillary Clinton's case, the very progressive side of Methodism. I think that people who are progressive need to signal that whether they are secular or not, whether they are religious or not, they are open to religious voices and do not have a prejudice against religious people. I think, secondly, we need to redefine the words family values in our country. For a long time, the slogan family values was used as a way of pushing back against feminists and against LGBTQ people. But I think if you look at where progressives are, they care passionately about the state of family life. They care passionately about how families in our economic circumstance can hold together, can take care of their kids, which is why when you talk about universally available childcare, you're talking about family values, because you're talking about issues that parents talk about at night over their kitchen tables or in the backyard. And so I think there are some of these hot button issues where progressives have let the language go to the right and have just not stood up in a vocal way for what they actually believe. They've almost been too troubled by the fact that the right wing has taken ownership of some of these ideas and been reluctant to talk about them. One of the best examples actually is the Reverend William Barber, who organized those Moral Mondays and is now organizing around the country on poverty. And he is making very clear that his commitments are to gospel values, and those gospel values point in a progressive direction when it comes to social, racial, and gender justice. And I think he's right.
Right. He has successfully revived the idea of Dr. King's Poor People's Campaign, and in talking about issues without necessarily labeling them as being around class, just talking about the morality of, you know, or immorality, if you will, of such obscene wealth inequality. Finally, EJ, do you feel that we are, I mean, this is sort of paraphrasing Joe Biden's ad campaign, but you feel that we're in this struggle for the soul of the nation, that we need to redefine who and what America is? If this pandemic and Trump's presidency has revealed anything, it is that American exceptionalism, if it ever was a thing, is really not a thing anymore. Outsiders pity America. I mean, they've said so in op-eds recently. If America isn't the world's leader, the exceptional one, what is America? And is it time for us to start redefining what this country is, rather than being a country defined by the greatest military in the world or the wealthiest nation in the world? What should we be defining this country around?
No, I think that's an excellent point. And I think you were channeling, consciously channeling Fintan O'Toole, the great Irish political writer, who said, you know, the world has reacted to America in many ways with love or hate or fear or admiration, but never before with pity. And looking at our leadership now and how Trump is dealing with the coronavirus compared to many other countries, this feeling of pity about us. That is, ironically and sadly, it's the very opposite of make America great again. You know, there are a lot of cliches of political life, but I've always still liked the cliche America is great when it is good. That I think if you look at our history, and Barack Obama was really effective in talking about this, there is a narrative of our history that talks about a country that has been in constant state of struggle for self-improvement. We started as a nation that countenanced slavery and was built on slavery in significant ways. And we eventually abolished slavery. We were a country then built on racial segregation and inequality, and we made extraordinary advances, not enough, but extraordinary advances in the civil rights years. In the Gilded Age, we had radical forms of inequality, which we began to correct, again, not as far as I would like to go, but in significant ways, during the New Deal and Great Society.
And all the examples you're citing are the result of pressure from the left and strong grassroots movements from below.
Correct. And in fact, one of the points I make in the book is that what we need in the country is a more functional relationship between, if you will, a liberal center-left center and progressive movements. One of the best two great examples of this, Sidney Hillman and the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, gave Roosevelt critical support, but also pushed him in a more progressive direction. The civil rights movement under Martin Luther King and a whole lot of other people, A. Philip Randolph and many others, felt correctly that the Kennedy administration was being too timid on civil rights. They pushed Kennedy and pushed LBJ. And this combined effect of social movements that move us in a more progressive direction, organized from below, on leaders who are broadly sympathetic to progressive goals, but may be more moderate, may even in some cases be more compromised.
Well, EJ, on that note, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us. Really appreciate
it. I am so grateful to be with you. Thank you so much.
My guest has been EJ Dionne. He's a columnist for The Washington Post, government professor at Georgetown University, a visiting professor at Harvard, and a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. We've been discussing his brand new book, Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.